You're listening to the Mission Ridge Church Podcast. Mission Ridge is a new church in Missoula, Montana. You can visit us online at missionridge.church. Thanks for tuning in.
All right. Time to be quiet. It's my turn to talk. Well, good morning. I hope your holidays were great. If you take time off during the holidays, you always know that the week of the holidays, you enjoy the family time, you enjoy the time having time off, but you also know that you have to cram so much more in the week in those days you don't have off to get everything done, and that's definitely what it felt like for me this week, and probably for all of our staff, and for all of you if you took time off this week. But I hope this Christmas holiday, as a church community, as we went through Advent and we took time to anticipate the arrival of the Christ child, the King, that this holiday just meant a little bit something more, that you realize that there is a King who has come into the world to grant hope and peace and joy and love, and to incite us to bring those same things to the world as well. This morning, we're doing just a one-off sermon. This is not a series. We are just kind of doing a bit of a recap, looking at where we're at as a church currently and where we want to go. And so we're going to kind of throw some numbers at you real quick and kind of go through those things kind of really quickly. And then I guess the real preaching happens at the end. So first off, we didn't do this during the welcome. We wanted to just tag it on to the sermon at the beginning. We want to talk about, just as a reminder, what our vision and mission is. And my hope is that this becomes so redundant that you roll your eyes and you can just mouth it to me because you've heard it so many times. So our vision is this: a movement of diverse people living out God's sacrificial love. For us, this is not just, to be honest, when we were working on our vision and mission statement, darn projector. When we were working on our vision and mission statement, there's a part of me that feels like every church's vision and mission statement is basically the same, that just uses slightly different words. And so I was questioning the validity of why we're even doing this. But as we worked through this and we landed here, I was really happy that we did go through this, because this really does, in a single phrase, encapsulate what we are all about, what we want to see as an end product of all of our efforts when it comes to Mission Ridge. We want to see people from vast different backgrounds, different histories, different stories, different ethnics, different social economic backgrounds, different political movements. I hope we have a bunch of Trump voters and those who hate Trump as well, because we need everyone's voices. And in our world today, we are probably more divided than any time in human history. Social media has not helped. It's made the problem worse. Mass media has not helped. It's made the problem worse. There is a quote from a guy by the name of Rene Girard. Kirsten, you'd probably enjoy reading some of his stuff. But he said once globalization, he said this back in 1940, I think. He said, once globalization has been fully achieved, all it will take is a single match to light the world on fire. And you see that happening. A small thing happens and it blows up everywhere, and a person's career is ruined, their life is ruined, the nation or the world is divided. The rise and fall of empires happened with just a single spark now. And I think that the church has the answer. We should be waving our hands saying, we know how to do this. We know how to live together. We know how to love each other well, even when we don't see eye to eye on some important issues. At the end of the day, what really matters is that we love each other well. We should have the answer, but the truth is the church oftentimes is the most divided of places, because we divide not just on particular viewpoints on religious doctrines. We will divide over the smallest of things. But we also divide even when it comes to ethnics. We will divide when it comes to social economics. We will divide over the style of worship. We'll divide over the smallest of things. We aren't, capital C Church is not doing this well today. And so for us at Mission Ridge, what we want to see is this. Because we believe if we can work towards this, people will see who our God is. They will understand the message of Christ and what his redemptive power in their life can be. The way we want to do this is this. This is our mission. Is we want to be raising biblical disciples who develop transparent or authentic relationships with one another, that sacrifice for other people, and heal divisions. So there's three parts to that. There's different ways to word this. And I actually kind of came up with a few different words. The idea of sacrificing for others, the word that we use a lot is generosity. Generosity is never convenient, it's never easy, and it shouldn't be comfortable. Generosity should require sacrifice. It should require that it costs us something, that we give something up. And there's tons of stories throughout Scripture, but my favorite story that Jesus talks about that illustrates this is the widow's mite. The widow that comes, and Jesus is observing all these rich people who come in and put large sums of money, but this poor widow comes and she puts all she has, about 1 cent's worth of income. And Jesus says, this woman has put more in than all these other people because they gave much, but they still had much left over. This woman gave everything she has and she has nothing now. And then he just ends the story. Like, we as a people, we want Jesus to keep talking about how this woman is rewarded or how she gets that money back or how God blesses. He doesn't do that. The story just ends. And God uses this poor widow. And for the last 2,000 years, she has been an example of what generosity looks like. Now, and we're going to talk a little bit more about generosity here in a bit after we go through some of these numbers. But let's keep working through these terms. Secondly, this idea of transparent relationships, or I like to use the word authentic. This ties into the DNA of where Mission Ridge comes from, and we use a phrase called relational discipleship a lot. And it's a phrase that we want to start teaching people and start training people in what relational discipleship really looks like. We have said almost every Sunday, we've always kind of brought it back, that Christianity is never an individual thing. It's always a community thing. And if you're not in an intentional community that is growing your faith, you're not walking as a Christian quite right yet. God always calls us into community. And there's several examples that we use that I think we sometimes use wrong. Like my favorite one is when we talk about how my body is a temple. And that's true, your body is a temple. But when you look at the text that comes from 1 Corinthians, Paul isn't saying that your individual body is a temple. He's saying all of your bodies together are a single temple. Peter uses a similar illustration where he says, all of you like living stones are being built up into a single temple. When we are all together, when we're all doing life together and walking this Christian faith out as a community, that is when God really starts to show up and we really get to see what God can do. And so this is why care groups is so important for us. This is why getting involved and not just in the church operations, the official church operations, but when it comes to doing life with one another. Are you being intentional in engaging people in your workplace, in your community, in your family, your social sphere? Are you being intentional about pulling people into that community? The third phrase is this idea of healing divisions. And this isn't just first and foremost, this is not about getting people to see eye to eye. That's not what this is about. This is about building bridges to people groups that are divided, whether that is whether that's actual distance or whether that's just the way they see things and their individual perspectives. This is really what this is about. And really what this entails is that we engage in conversations well. And sometimes that means that we have to shut up because Christians can be quite vocal and opinionated. And sometimes that means that we have to listen better and seek to understand. We have to let go of this weird desire that we have to be right all the time. If you've had kids, you know how annoying that is. Like, they always want to correct you, and you just want to shut them up and just do what you're told to do and stop correcting me. Like, we know how annoying this is, but yet as a Christian faith, as a Christian community, this is how we often engage, and it doesn't work well. So oftentimes what this means is that we have to listen better and understand better. And we have to be okay with other people thinking differently. We have to be willing. One of these days, I'm going to go off on a huge scapegoat tangent, and it's going to be you're going to be rolling your eyes, thinking like, why does this matter? However, sometimes what this means is that we have to become the scapegoat. We have to be willing to own the burden, even if we don't deserve it. We have to bear the weight of other people's flaws and mistakes and their own troubles. Because that's what Christ did for us, and this is what Christ calls us to do. So where are we at as a church community? Here's some numbers. We've been around the averaging attendance of about 40 people. Kind of goes up and down over the holidays. We kind of took a dip. We had three Sundays pretty close together where we couldn't meet in this facility. And what happened with that, which is not surprising, we lost some momentum. It's not surprising. They start getting the habit of, attending a church service and getting involved, and then all of a sudden you have a week off, and they get to sleep in, and then the next Sunday comes along, and they forget to set their alarm, or, it's not surprising. But we've been around that 40 people mark. We've had 5 baptisms since we started September 9th, which, by the way, is already 5 times higher than the national average for a church in a given year, so that's awesome. We are around, as far as outside support, not the money that comes in here locally, but the people that support us from the outside, we are averaging around the $3,000 per month as far as other partner, either individuals or organizations like other churches that are financially supporting us. Internally, we are around the $4,600 mark per month. It's kind of where we're at. With all that said, where is this money going? Obviously, everything from salary is a big thing, equipment, rent, a lot of things like that. But one of the things I want to share with you that we've, from the beginning, churches like to encourage people to tithe, which you should do. However, oftentimes churches themselves don't tithe. And we've talked in the past how the tithe is not just 10%. The Old Testament tithe was actually 23.3%. And so we, early on, we weren't doing good about making sure we were spending money. However, since we've started, we have spent roughly $9,400 on generosity, which is actually a huge chunk of change. $2,100 of that has gone to local benevolent needs. So this could be, someone needs a place to crash, or they need some food, or whatever struggle they're having. We've been able to financially partner with them and help them in that immediate need. We've also partnered with several organizations. We've given about $655 to the Watson's Children's Shelter to help them meet the needs of kids who just, whatever crisis they're going through, they have a safe place to land. Watson's also does a lot of work. They're doing a lot of work now with preventative measures and trying to, especially with teenage or single moms, trying to work with them because they're just at a higher risk. And so they're doing a lot of good work there. We have given about $1,900 to church planting. It's interesting because from a financial standpoint, I remember when my wife and I were trying to get out of debt, and we went through, I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University. And one of his rules is that you always give away 10% of your income. It doesn't matter how much in debt you are or how poor you are, you just make it a rule. 10% of your income always goes out. And one of the illustrations he likes to use is that an open hand doesn't just give away better, it also receives better. And it's actually a great biblical principle that we'll probably talk about in the future. How do we believe that God made the world good and full of abundance, or do we believe in this world of scarcity where we have to hold on? And when we do that, we close ourselves off, not just to other people, but also to what God wants to do in our life. And so as a church plant, we wanted to also practice this. So we are financially supporting other church plants. And our goal at the beginning was to start off giving away 10% of whatever comes in. Our goal long-term is to get that up to 20%, where 20% of everything that comes in, we are supporting other needs, not just locally, but even through other church plants. We have also partnered with, it's called 549 Hope, and it's kind of a central hub that a lot of churches have set up and are now using, and it's directed through the Union Gospel Mission. And so we partnered with them, and if there's a need, we're able to connect them with that, and then we can meet the need through them, if that kind of makes sense. And the reason we do it this way is so we can keep, we can keep track, and we can also connect them to better resources that we don't have access to. The Union Gospel Mission and 549 Hope is going to be much more aware of some of the services that these people can receive that we may not be capable of providing. We said from the beginning, like when we came to Missoula, we don't want to do everything. We want to find the things that are already happening and partner with those and support them so they can do their job better. And we also want to find the gaps in Missoula, that those things that are preventing people from excelling and moving on in their life, finding healing and redemption. We want to find those gaps, and those are the things we want to do. And so Union Gospel Mission and 549 Hope is just one of those examples of a partner organization that we are able to come alongside and support. We're also looking at partnering with a local Christian youth ministry. And I'm excited for that. We already have a relationship with them, but we're still trying to formalize that. We'll have more information on that coming up in the future. And we have dedicated about $4,500 to Generosity Feeds, this initiative to feed, to provide 10,000 meals for kids that struggle with food insecurity in our area. And that's currently, and that'll probably go up. Now, with all those numbers, where do we want to be? And whenever we set goals, there's always this struggle between being wise and resourceful, as well as trying to also, take a risk and live in faith. Like, if we're around the 40 mark and we say in 2019 we want to reach 50 people, that's not really, a good goal. So we want to increase our numbers by tenfold. And that's doable. The relational discipleship model is not a microwave, it's a crock pot, but it has exponential growth. It picks up steam slowly at the beginning, but then as it builds, it blows up exponentially. And we'll talk more and more about that, but this idea of relational discipleship is that we are all called to be disciples, and disciples ultimately make disciples. And discipleship is not teaching, it is not having a lesson, it is not going to a Bible study, it is not any of those. Discipleship is always an individual relationship that you have with someone else, where you walk alongside them and you guide them closer and closer to Christ so that they can become more and more the image of God that God created them in, created them to be. That we call out their potential, that we help them with the messes of their life, that we inspire them. And that we find opportunities for them to grow and to lead and to engage the world the way God wants them to engage. So we want to go from 40 to 300 is what we're looking at. Our goal from the beginning is we wanted to have 20 baptisms in the first year. We're 25% there. Next year, we want to have 30 baptisms per year. Currently, we have, my notes are wrong on this. Currently, we have 3 care groups up and running. And we have a 4th that is coming starting January 9th as well. We would love to get that number. We want about a 75% ratio of people that show up Sunday morning. We want about 75% of those people to be actively involved in a care group. What that means is that we need about 35 care groups. So we would have about 225 people that are meeting during the week, that are engaging in relationships in the community, that are getting to know one another, that when there's a need, when stuff hits the fan, you know, they know there's a group of people that they can rely on and that they can count on. And Rob helped and led and directed care groups a lot in Moscow. And there were just so many cool stories that came out of care groups. People that had needs in the care group would rally around that person and help meet that need and through that time. Currently, we have, like I said, 3,000 of outside monthly support. We want to get that up to 6,500 outside monthly support. Internally, our goal eventually as a church is to be financially independent. On average, it takes a church plan about 5 years to get there. We would really like to blow that number up and like get there like in a year. That'd be great. We know it's not going to happen. Well, I don't know. I don't know what God's going to do. Typically, it doesn't happen that way. To get to the point of being financially independent, we need to go from about $4,600 of monthly offering to about $20,000 in monthly offering, just to maintain what we are already kind of doing and what our plans are. And lastly, and probably most importantly, is we want to continue to grow our efforts to engage in generosity and service in our community. Now, you've probably heard this phrase in churches before, and I agree with it. One thing you'll get to know more and more about me is I agree with everything and disagree with everything. It's fun being married to me and working with me, right, Rob? Yeah, thumbs up. So with all that said, you've heard this phrase, it's not about the numbers. And that's true. What is meant by that is that we're not just trying to get butts into seats so we can feel good about ourselves. We're not just trying to do an amazing program where we can attract a bunch of people, get their butts in the seats, and then we can pat ourselves on the back saying that we did our job well. So that part is true. However, numbers always represent people. And if you have a goal but you can't measure whether or not you met that goal, then how do you know you actually achieved what you set out to accomplish? So when we throw a bunch of numbers out, I want you to hear that our heart is not about trying to feel good about ourselves. Our heart is we want to be able to measure well what we are attempting to do in the Missoula area, if that makes sense. And I shared a couple of weeks ago, I hate talking about money. I just hate it. I would rather skip it, and for the first few months that we were here, whenever we talked about the offering, I would just try to fly through as quickly as possible and say as little about it because it makes me feel all insecure and vulnerable, and I hated it. And then Rob challenged me and told me to buck up, Buttercup, and you need to talk more directly about this. So this is one of my New Year's resolutions. I need to be more direct about this. So when we talk about numbers, when we talk about money, the heart behind it is not so we can feel secure and comfortable. Our heart is that there is work to do. There are things to be done. There's needs to be met. I mean, there's just so much brokenness in our community, and not just in our community. Like, we think of the bad stories, but even in our own hearts and our own lives, when we think about, if we're courageous enough, we know there's brokenness in our life. And it takes time, and it takes resources, and it takes energy to help meet those needs. And this is why we're talking numbers. Can we measure these things well? And we also want to set numbers so we have a goal to shoot for. We may not hit 300. We might only hit 100. Or we might only hit 60. I don't know. But we need to shoot for something. And too often, churches will, this is just a common story, and I know a lot of your stories, and you've been part of churches like this, where early on, you know, they were on mission, they were driven, they were passionate, they loved Christ and they loved people well, they were going for it. And then something happens along the way where they start to get comfortable instead. And they get in a routine, and things just become kind of methodical, and there's no more passion, there's no more drive, and different things become important. The reason that we set numbers is to make sure that we are going after the things that God wants us to go after. Does it matter if we hit 300? No. What matters is, are we reaching one person at a time? Because if we only reach one person this next year, it's been worth it. Because one person isn't just one person, it's a whole family lineage that can come after that. Some of your own personal stories, you've grown up in homes where generations of like addiction wrecked your family. And maybe it was your father, maybe it was your mother, maybe it was you. Someone along the line broke that chain. And because of that, this whole family tree is forever changed for the good. If we can reach only one person this next year, it's worth it because people matter in God's view. And so they should matter to us. If we could reach more than one person, that's even better. So with all that said, I actually want to get into some scripture now. Before we read these passages, I need to teach you a little bit of Hebrew. And let me be honest with you, I have not studied Hebrew. I'm just really good at Google. Like, that's really the truth. And I've picked up things over time, but like I'm not familiar with Hebrew. I just look up the words and study the words. I do word studies, sure. But all this stuff you could do on your own. You could get the Blue Letter Bible app, and you could open a passage, go to its interlinear concordance, and then you could look at the words. It has a little speaker icon. You could click that, and it'll even pronounce it for you. So everything we do Sunday morning, you could do yourself. Don't be impressed. I'm sure you're not anyway. But anyway, so a couple things we need to talk about. There's this word that we often translate as righteousness in the Old Testament. The word righteousness is this Hebrew word, zedekah. So say zedekah. It has a TZ at the beginning. It's kind of like the pterodactyl, but with a TZ instead. And zedekah comes from a word zedek. So say zedek. And it's the word that we translate as righteousness. However, in the Hebrew mindset, righteousness is not the way we think of it today. In Christianity, righteousness has become this idea of everything about me is morally right and morally good. And part of that's kind of true with this idea of zedekah, but it's actually more about generosity. If you go to a Jewish synagogue, a lot of times they will have a box in the back, and it's their offering box, and it's called the zedekah box. This is where you put your offering. This is where, from this offering, they help meet the needs of their community. In the Jewish worldview, you are expected to give at least 10% of your income to the poor, not to the synagogue necessarily, but to the poor. And this is not just about being generous. This is actually a moral obligation, a way of life. And it's not about just meeting quick needs or giving quick handouts. Zedekah was this idea of restoring the rightness back to the world. If there was something wrong with the world, God's righteous people were a people that would restore rightness to it. From the beginning, we see a world that God creates that is peaceful, not in the sense of absence of conflict, but peaceful in the sense of the Hebrew idea of shalom, that it's as it should be. Everything is in proper working order. It's healthy, it's good, it's full of potential and vibrancy. And so a people of peace are a people that we try to restore the shalom to the chaos that has been introduced into our world. And it's the same idea with righteousness. It's a calling of a way of life. And it has this idea of generosity in that we, when we see something wrong with the world, we are the type of individuals and community that engage with that wrongness to restore it back to right. And you can see how this is a little bit different than just quick handouts or just writing a check. It means that you have to be, your energy and your attention has to be involved into it. Because if you see someone that has a need and all you do is just give them some money, that's sure, that's good and that's generous. But true zedekah means that you work with that person. You help get that person connected so that they can be fully restored to a right way of living. Another principle, by the way, of this Jewish idea of zedekah is that you should never give so much that you yourself become a burden to society. I remember there was a... My dad posed this question, and I'm not sure where he got it, but he said, if you can give $100 and that $100 would cure one man's blindness, would you do it? And the answer for most of us would be, yeah, I mean, $100 is cheap for someone who's blind to have their sight restored. He said, all right, how many people's sight would you restore? Because there comes a point, at some point, you yourself are now becoming the person in need. And this is a common Jewish principle that you find even in the New Testament. Paul says, I believe in Thessalonians, that he who is poor needs to work. That way that person himself isn't a burden to society, but can actually contribute to society. Like our goal as the people of God should be that we get to a point that we can bless and restore the rightness back to the world. And for my wife and I, when we were working on trying to get out of debt, this was one of our big goals. Because there were so many times there was a need and we wanted to help, but we had to buy mac and cheese. Like the struggle was real. We weren't sure how we were going to pay rent or how we're going to be able to pay off our bills. And so once we got debt free, we can actually help needs. When a need comes up, when we know there's a need, we actually have the ability to say, you know what? We can actually cut a couple things and we're going to be fine. We're not sacrificing the safety of our family to do this. So this is zedekah. There's another word that wasn't going to be in the notes or on the slides, and I need to teach it as well because it's kind of, it sounds similar. It's this word mishpat. Say mishpat. And it's a word often translated justice. Now, in our Western world, when we think of justice, we think of usually retributive justice, where if someone does something wrong, they get punished. And you will find that in the scriptures. There is definitely retributive justice in the scriptures. However, mishpat is typically more restorative justice. It's the justice that a widow seeks when her case is not being heard. It is the justice given to the orphans when they are restored to a family. It is the justice given to a stranger in the Old Testament when he finds a people that he can live with and that he can flourish in that community. It's more about restorative justice. We would use the phrase social justice. Now, if you're far on the right side of politics, sometimes social justice makes you cringe. But this actually is an Old Testament and New Testament idea. The idea that justice, mishpat, is that we are restoring the justness, the rightness, again, back to the world. Now, with those two ideas in mind, we're going to read two passages from Isaiah. And these two passages are... Isaiah is a great book. This is why we named our second child after it. It's a great book. And we're going to talk about him a little bit at the end, but there is so much in Isaiah that Jesus pulls from and quotes from over and over again. Here's a passage that I want us to focus on. Isaiah 32, 1 through 3. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness. This is that word, zedekah. A king will reign in righteousness. How many kings are there? One. There you go. Next part. And princes will rule injustice. This is that word mishpat. How many princes are there? More than one. So there is a single king who will rule in righteousness. We know who this is. This is Jesus, the coming king that we just celebrated. But who are the princes? It's us. A king will rule in zedekah, and princes will rule in mishpat. How will they rule? What would this look like? Each will be like a hiding place from the wind, a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry place, like the shade of a great rock in a weary land. You get the picture of what it's trying. You see what righteousness and justice looks like. You provide comfort and safety and restoration to the people seeking it. You are a safe place that people know they will be protected by. Like, this is what princes that rule through mishpat look like. This is what the reign of a king who rules through righteousness, through zedekah, looks like. And then if we do this, when this happens, this is the result, verse 3. Then the eyes of those who see will not be closed, and the ears of those who hear will give attention. We've all had people in our life that we know they need help. We know they need help. And sometimes it's a sibling, sometimes it's a parent, sometimes it's a child. Oftentimes it's a close friend or just those people we engage with on a weekly basis. We know they need help, but they won't listen or they can't see it. And oftentimes it's that they refuse to listen and they refuse to see. And God's promises in Isaiah 32, 1 through 3 is if we are princes who rule through Mishpat under the reign of a king who rules through Zedekiah, then we will be a shelter from the storm. We will be like a shade under a great rock. Like, then we will do that. And if we do that, then they can hear and then they will see. We've also known what it's like when people try to correct us and fix our problems for us, but they're not a shelter. They're not a place of relief and safety. Like, we know what that's like. It's the people in our life that are truly vulnerable and truly safe that we actually listen to. Another passage from Isaiah, Isaiah 58, 6 through 8. Isaiah 58, the passage starts with God saying, you seem like a people that seek me. You pretend like you actually care about who I am and what I'm all about. And then you wonder why when you fast, I don't listen to you. When you go through these seasons of fasting, why I don't respond. And he says, because you're fasting for your own self-gain, to make yourself feel better. And then God says, this is the type of fast I look for. When it comes to not eating food, when it comes to depriving yourself, what am I actually looking for? He says this, is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke. This is the idea of slavery and oppression. When it comes to fasting, what is God really looking for? To relieve the oppression that often happens in society. To let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. This is a Hebrew idiom for your own people, your own flesh and blood. To not hide yourself from them. To not, when you see someone in need, not to turn your eyes the other way. And if we do this, then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness, your tzedakah, shall go before you. Your generosity and the way that you restore rightness to the world will actually precede you if you live this way, if you set your mind and your heart to live in this fashion. And the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Now, there's a lot of cool little imagery that's happening here, but I want to focus on this one idea of your light shall spring forth like the dawn. I'm convinced that when Jesus is preaching his Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, Matthew most likely doesn't record one sermon. He probably records a bunch of sermons and kind of combines them together as in the Matthew 5 through, I think, 7 chapters. He kind of combines this as the ideal message of what Jesus is all about. This is everything that Jesus is attempting to convey in the world. This is the summary of his teachings. So in Matthew 5, Jesus goes through all these beatitudes. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. And once again, it's this idea of tzedakah. And then after the beatitudes, he says this, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Now, there's two uses for salt in the ancient world. One was for the preservation of meat. Yes, they used it for flavor, but honestly, salt was for the preservation of meat, especially for armies. There was a common salt tax that they would have because armies would have to bring their meat with them or store meat because you had to feed a lot of mouths. And the only way that they could preserve this meat was through basically brining it to make sure that disease and bacteria would not infect it. However, there was a second use for salt. And believe it or not, it was used as fertilizer, especially in Israel. Now, we often think of, when we think of salt, we only think of like the table salt that we have. That doesn't work well as fertilizer. But in the ancient world, there was actually multiple types of salt. Even today, there's multiple types of salt. One of my relatives gave me a variety salt pack, and I was really impressed with how many different types of salt there were. But in the ancient world, they would use salt as fertilizer. And what Jesus is saying here, twofold, if you lose your saltiness, you can't preserve life and you can't bring life. But he doesn't stop. He says this, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, In the same way that a light is meant to give light to everyone, not just a selective group of people and not to be concealed, in the same way, let your light shine before others. I am convinced Jesus is referencing Isaiah 58 here. Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works. We often think of good works as like a list of things I have done. This is not the Hebrew mindset of good works. This is the way you work in your life. The thing, the cumulative, I can't say that word, the collection of all the things you do, those good things, let them see that. Let your light shine before people so that they can give glory to your Father who's in heaven. Peter says something similar in his epistle where he says, let your work before the Gentiles be honorable so that they may, on the day of his arrival, they may give glory to God. Like the way we engage the world, are we a light to it? Are we a shelter from the storm? Do we bring relief in the desert? Do we break the yokes of oppression? Do we feed the hungry? Do we take the poor into our house? How do we live our life? And more importantly, as a church community, how are we going to be seen? Like for me, I think so often when we talk about evangelism, we think about apologetics and we think about the four spiritual laws and we think about how we have to convince people they're sinners and then we have to convince them that they're going to be punished. And then after that, we have to convince them that, by the way, God who was angry at you also loves you a lot and there's this way out of it. Like we think about that. However, there is like those methods aren't necessarily displayed in scripture. The actual methods of winning people to Christ is almost always tied back to the way we love and serve others. You see it in Isaiah 32, you see it in Isaiah 58, you see it in Matthew 5. You see it in Matthew 25 when Jesus says, the least you do unto these, you do it unto me. You really want to live your life and you really want to reach people one person at a time. You really want to actually engage this world. Then we as a church community have to love well. And that doesn't mean talking all the time. Like people know deep down that they're messed up. I think you know deep down that you have issues. And if you don't know you have issues, you have more than most do. Like, people already know that. And in our time today, if we're honest, and let's just be frank, the world is kind of tired of Christianity. They've heard it all before. It's time for them to stop hearing things and start seeing how we live differently, how we love differently, as a church community and as individuals. As care groups and as family units. Matthew 28. Oh, geez. I heard it said that Jesus' last word should be our first concern. Matthew 28 says this. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations. And I won't read the rest. Because all authority in heaven and earth has been given to Jesus, Jesus' last command to his disciples is to go and make disciples. The truth is that many Christians will spend their life as Christians and never actually produce another Christian. They will never actually help someone walk closer to Christ who was walking far from him on a different path and then help them guide them to walking a different way of life, following a different Lord. For us as a real life church plant, the thing that we have to own is that disciples make disciples. And it's not about a quick conversion. It's not about getting someone to say a sinner's prayer or getting them to respond to an altar call or even just get them baptized. Discipleship is always a journey, not a destination. It's always walking with people in their life, coming alongside them wherever they are and helping them reach a new level. And for us at Mission Ridge, this is the thing that we're hoping this DNA starts to get instilled into you. That you will start seeing your life differently, that everything about your life, that disciple making is not just a section of your life, but it's the entirety of your life. That everything you do, every person you engage with, you are actively trying to make disciples of Christ through the methods that we've already shared. Now, some implications for you. Number one, sharing Christ with Missoula must be a way of life driven by an outward mindset. There is a book by the Arbiter Institute called The Outward Mindset. Read it. It's really short and quick. Like you can read it in an afternoon. Read it. It's really good. And it's not a Christian book, it's for businesses. And this whole book is about how businesses could actually be more effective if they actually looked at other people and cared about them. Crazy idea. It's like Jesus said that or something. But it's a great book. And this is what I mean about an outward mindset. Oftentimes, we have an inward mindset. We think about our needs and what we have to protect and what we have to have. We think about our own inconveniences. And what happens when we do that is we view other people as objects and not actually as people. That people that God created and that God desperately loves. If we are going to share Christ with the world, we have to have an outward mindset. If we have an inward and self-focused mindset as individuals and also as a church community, not only do we not share Jesus with people, we actually do something worse. We share an inaccurate view of who Jesus is to the world. And that's actually worse because now we have to fix it. And too many people have a bad image of who Jesus and who God is. And we need to start correcting it. Number two, the mantle of Christian demands a way of living that is generous and sacrificial. This is called ministry. The word minister or ministry actually means service, which comes from this idea of servant. And all the apostles use this idea. They use this title for themselves. They viewed themselves as sacrificing themselves so that they could better others and spread the gospel of Christ to the world. They gave, most, all of them gave up everything they had, including their lives, for other people, and that they would do the same. To be a Christian means that we are sacrificial. It means that we are generous. Number three, the Christian faith requires engaging community and connecting others to community. There is no such thing as a lone wolf Christian. And like you have to engage in community and be active in it. And I know it's hard with new community, and you all are weird. And sometimes I hang out with you, and I just want to hide in the bedroom. I do this, actually, sometimes if you ever come to my house, we have a bunch of people, I'll hang out for about 15 minutes and go disappear for about five. Like, I just keep doing this. I understand that going to a new group of people and trying to get connected with them, trying to get to know them and let them get to know you, it's awkward and it's weird and it's uncomfortable, and you might, like, you'd probably be rather playing your PS4. That's what I've been doing a lot recently. Like, you'd rather maybe disengage from that. But to be a Christian means we have to engage in it. And hear me, it gets better over time. People will start to love you, and you can start to love them. And yeah, they're still weird, and they still drive you nuts, and they still say those stupid things or have those weird habits. They still have those. But they start to become family, a good family. And we have to connect other people to that as well. They say it takes, on average, 7 invites for someone to come to a church service. I don't know what the stats are for a care group. I think it might be less. But it takes time. You can't just invite once. You can't just share social media posts, which please do. Share all of our social media posts. But that's not how we get people into community. It takes relationship to start pulling someone into community. Lastly, we have work to do. We have work to do. And we all have our part to play. We all have a part to play. So the question is that we want you to wrestle with as we go into this new year is, what will you do in 2019? And for us as a community, what will we do in 2019? Will Missoula be a better place? Are there pockets in Missoula that God has not found, I put quote marks on that for the podcast, where God has not found that we can bring God to? Like, how will we make an impact in Missoula this year?
You've been listening to the Mission Ridge Church Podcast. Mission Ridge is a new church in Missoula, Montana. For more information about Mission Ridge, please visit us online at missionridge.church. If you are in the Missoula area, we would love to meet you. We hold service at the Hilton Garden Inn Conference Center on Sundays at 10:30 a.m. We would love to have you join us. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.